It will help you to have the Bible because we're going to be looking at the whole of this book of Jonah. And just as an introduction, I will read the first three verses. The word of the Lord came to Jonah, son of Amittai. Go to the great city of Nineveh and preach against it, because its wickedness has come up before me. But Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. He went down to Joppa, where he found a ship bound for that port. After paying the fare, he went aboard and sailed for Tarshish to flee from the Lord. There are some people in this world, of course, whose problem is that they can't say no. They work themselves into an early grave, perhaps, as a result of taking on far more than they can actually do. If you ask my wife, she will tell you I tend in that direction, but it's really not true. That wasn't Jonah's problem, anyway. The trouble with Jonah was he couldn't say yes. God had a job for him to do. He was calling him to be a missionary to the ancient city of Nineveh. And not to put too fine a point on it, Jonah simply didn't want to go. Surveying his story as a whole, I reckon there were at least three factors that contributed to this reluctance of his. And to make sense of what happens to him, I think it's easiest to identify what they were right from the start. First of all, Jonah's idea of God seems to have been far too small. He seems to have imagined that the power of Jehovah, the Lord God of Israel, was somehow limited to the four corners of his own country. I guess if he'd been summoned to be a prophet in Jerusalem or Samaria, he might well have agreed more readily. But Nineveh, you see, was the capital city of a pagan land, Assyria. It was a city notorious for its size and its wickedness and its godlessness. And it was 1,000 miles away from Gath-Hepha, the little village where his dad Amittai was. Jonah just wasn't sure, I think, that his God could be relied upon to look after him in such a remote and formidable place. His idea of God, as I say, was too small. The second factor that contributed to his reluctance, I think, was this, that his own experience of God was rather too shallow. Now, I am speculating a little bit here, but I have a strong suspicion that Jonah had never really felt his own personal need of God's saving grace, at least not very intensely. We know from 2 Kings chapter 14 that Jonah lived during the reign of King Jeroboam II. It was a prosperous time in Israel. There was lots of money around. Jeroboam, you see, was an able general, and he had made the nation militarily secure. Indeed, he'd recovered a considerable amount of territory which had been occupied by enemy forces in earlier years. The book of Amos, which also dates from around about this time, tells us of the luxury which many people in Israel enjoyed during Jeroboam II's reign. It was a time of supreme optimism and national confidence. And no doubt Jonah was, to some extent at any rate, infected by that rather complacent mood in his country. He'd never experienced the judgment of God himself on his land. He'd never been delivered from the judgment of God himself. And so the message of judgment on Nineveh, which God was commissioning him to preach, I suspect, was not one which he could identify with any profound degree of emotional sympathy or engagement. His experience of God, as I say, was perhaps a bit on the shallow side. The third factor, which I am secure about, though, that contributed to his reluctance was this. His concern for other people, and particularly for other nations, was just too restricted. Jonah was a nationalist. And naturally, he wanted Israel's current prosperity to continue. Assyria was an enemy power, and potentially a very powerful one at that. Perhaps with the sixth sense of a prophet, he could already foresee the military expansionism that would characterize Assyria a few years later on. Perhaps he could foresee the vast empire that Nineveh would one day rule, the humiliating defeat which her armies would inflict on just about every other nation in the Middle East, including, of course, Israel. Certainly his prophetic colleague Amos anticipated that. Whether Jonah anticipated it too, we can only guess. But what is not in doubt is that, frankly, Jonah did not want Assyria to find the mercy of God. If God planned judgment on Syria, so much the better. Why should he warn them of their peril? To send him to Nineveh to evangelize the Assyrians was a bit like sending a Bosnian to Belgrade to evangelize the Serbs. It was against his people's political interest to see Nineveh blessed. And patriot that he was, Jonah couldn't bring himself to be the agent of such blessing. So he said no. His idea of God was too small. His experience of God was too shallow. His concern for other people was too restricted. Dare I ask whether you're saying no to God about anything at the moment? Perhaps like Jonah, if you're honest, you can sense that he is calling you in some way. Maybe you're not a Christian at all, and you sense that he's calling you to become a believer. Maybe you are a Christian and you sense that he's calling you to some kind of service for him. But either way, you are unwilling to yield. Well, be warned. God has his ways of demolishing the reluctance of those who dare to resist him. And sometimes those ways are pretty rough, as Jonah discovered to his cost. So come with me into his story tonight. Learn with Jonah first the lesson of the storm, then the lesson of the fish, and finally the lesson of the vine. First, the lesson of the storm. Jonah ran away from the Lord and headed for Tarshish. Tarshish was the port that we know today as Cadiz in Spain. So Jonah was contemplating just about the longest and most dangerous voyage anyone could undertake in those days, involving the navigation of the entire length of the Mediterranean Sea. Only the courageous mariners of Phoenicia would have undertaken it, I think. You see him, the way his mind was working. He wanted to evade God's call, to run away from God, as the text puts it. And he thought he could succeed in doing that by putting as many miles as possible between himself and the land of Israel. Such is the determination of this man to say no. He's prepared to risk a formidable journey because he thinks miles can work an escape for him. There's a story told I rather like of a little boy who was asking his mother one day about God. "Where is God?" he asked his mother. "Why," replied his mother, "God's everywhere, my dear." "Is he in this house?" "Oh, yes, he's in this house." "Is he in this room?" "Yes, he's in this room," said his mother. "Is he in that milk bottle?" "Yes, I suppose he's in the milk bottle too," said his mother, somewhat theologically out of her depth. The little boy grinned. "Got him!" Jonah's mind was working in a not dissimilar way. Clearly he believed that he could limit God's power to a particular area, the borders of his own country. "If I get away from here, I'll get away from him," he reasoned. He fled to Tarshish from the Lord's presence. Can't you sense the haste with which he embarks on his escape plan, dashing down to Joppa, then frantically inquiring along the dockside for a boat that's leaving soon, and immediately he finds one, paying for his berth in advance, cash on the nail. No son of Jacob ever parted with his money so readily. For Jonah just wanted to get away, you see. Away from Israel, away from God. But alas, he would find escape more difficult than he thought. What is it the psalmist says? "If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in hell, you are there. If I take the wings of the dawn and dwell in the far side of the sea, even there your right hand will hold me fast. The Lord sent a great wind on the sea, and such a violent storm arose that the ship threatened to break up. All the sailors were afraid, and each cried out to his own God, and they threw the cargo into the sea to lighten the ship. But Jonah had gone below deck, where he lay down and fell into a deep sleep. You see, he really thought he'd got away with it. Right up until the last moment, I think his heart must have been in his mouth, but once he saw the sailors casting off the ropes and heard the thud of the anchor as it was hauled on board and felt the gentle rolling of the sea as his little craft noses its way out of the harbour into the open sea, it's as if a great weight of anxiety is lifted from his shoulders. A bit like a fleeing prisoner of war who has run the gauntlet of Nazi search parties and at last finds himself across the Swiss border in neutral territory. I've made it, he says. I've escaped. And with a big sigh, he flops down into his bunk. And with his body and mind relaxed at last, he falls immediately into a deep sleep. So deep, he doesn't hear when the thunder starts to rumble and the boat begins to heave. He doesn't even hear the noise of the cargo being dragged across the deck or the panic-stricken shouts of the crew as they jettison it in a desperate attempt to ride out the storm, a storm so severe it even terrifies them, hardened sailors though they clearly were. The captain went to him and said, "How can you sleep? Get up and call on your God. Maybe he will take notice of us and we will not perish." Now there's an ironic rebuke for you. Here is the missionary being told by the pagan he ought to be praying. But then that's exactly what Jonah needed to learn, wasn't it? That God was by no means as remote from pagan lands and pagan hearts as he so conceitedly assumed. Beware of arrogance when you go to witness to your unbelieving friend, Christian. Maybe he doesn't know the Bible as well as you do, but his ignorance doesn't preclude the possibility that God has already been dealing with him. You may discover to your surprise he has as much or more to teach you than you have to teach him. "Get up and call on your God," says the captain. What a chaos of thoughts must have swirled through Jonah's mind at those words. Pray? How could Jonah pray? He had got into this boat to get away from God's presence. If his God was still accessible in the middle of the ocean, what on earth was the logic of his flight? Yet, these heathen he so despised seemed to find no great intellectual problem about praying to their gods in the middle of the ocean. So was the God of Israel less powerful than they were? Was his arm shorter than theirs? A nagging doubt begins to assail Jonah's mind, and suddenly his prophetic intuition is sparked into activity once again. Could it be that this storm was his doing? At last, Jonah's suspicions on that score are quickly confirmed. Then the sailors said to each other, "Come, let us cast lots to find out who is responsible for this calamity." Yes, you got it. They cast lots and the lot fell on Jonah. Of course, the random fall of a dice is modern man's guarantee that this world of ours is ruled by blind chance, isn't it? That's where Jonah and these sailors, primitive though our modern man may think them, actually is wiser than they. There is a meaning in events, even so-called chance events. The superstitious may call it fate, the Christian believer calls it providence. But both are testifying to the same innate conviction that we human beings have, that there is an unseen power in this universe who is working out his purpose and to whom we are accountable. So they asked him, "Tell us, Who is responsible for making all this trouble for us? What do you do? Where do you come from? What is your country? From what people are you? Can't you imagine that in the midst of the terrifying roar of the storm and this belligerent inquisition on the part of the crew, suddenly Jonah, the reluctant missionary, rediscovers his vocation. He is a prophet of the Lord after all. He answered, I am a Hebrew, and I worship the Lord, the God of heaven, who made the sea and the land. Verse 12, pick me up, throw me into the sea, and it will become calm. I know that it is my fault that this great storm has come upon you. Verse 14, then the crew cried to the Lord, O Lord, please do not let us die for taking this man's life. Do not hold us accountable for killing an innocent man. For you, O Lord, have done as you pleased. And then they took Jonah and threw him overboard, and the raging sea grew calm. At this, the men greatly feared the Lord, Jehovah. And they offered a sacrifice to the Lord and made vows to him. You know, the irony of these verses is just too exquisite for words. Here is Jonah running away because he is unwilling to be a witness to a foreign people. And what do we find him doing? Witnessing the foreigners. Here is Jonah running away because he doesn't want a foreign people to find deliverance from judgment. And what do we find happening as a result of his testimony? Foreign people finding deliverance. Here is Jonah running away because his God is far too small to protect him in Nineveh. And what do we find him saying? I fear the God of heaven who created the sea and the land. Throw me off the ship, boys. It's going the wrong way as far as I'm concerned. I must disembark immediately. You see then how Jonah's horizons have suddenly expanded. His God was no tribal deity tied to the parochial borders of Israel. The very idea of running away from the Lord is ridiculous, for he is the sovereign who rules the wind and the waves, who controls the fall of the lot, even here, in the middle of nowhere. His God had been too small, all right, but now he had burst the milk bottle in which Jonah had tried to confine him. Are you saying no to God this evening? Trying, like Jonah maybe, to escape the magnetic field of his call upon your life? The storm will come upon you. And it will not abate till you surrender. It's a wasted effort to try and run away from this God, you see. You think perhaps he's a tyrant, bullying you in that way? No, no. He is a lover. And like all lovers, he will not lightly take no as your answer to his wooing of your heart. Some of you know these lines. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind. And in the midst of tears, I hid from him, and under running laughter, up vistaed hopes I sped and shot, precipitated adown titanic glooms of chasmed fears. From those strong feet that followed after. But with unhurrying chase and unperturbed pace, deliberate speed, majestic instancy, they beat. And a voice beat more instant than the feet. All things betray thee who betrayest me. The lesson of the storm. You cannot run away from the hound of heaven. So we come to the lesson of the fish. Verse 17 of the first chapter. But the Lord provided a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was inside the fish 3 days and three nights. From inside the fish, Jonah prayed to the Lord his God. Now, I am not going to spend time tonight discussing whether we are intended to take Jonah's fish literally or not, or if we are meant to take it literally, what kind of fish could possibly swallow a man alive in this way. Suffice it to say, Jesus seems to have regarded this story as factual. He goes so far as to analogize Jonah's deliverance to the miracle of his own resurrection. In Matthew chapter 12, Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly, he says, of the fish. And in the same way, the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. For many of us, Jesus' verdict, I think, will settle the matter. But if you want to tell me tonight that you have a big problem believing in Jonah's whale, and that you find it easier to treat this story as wholly or partially fictional, I am not going to fight you on the issue. For the key thing about this fish is not the authenticity of its Piscine credentials. The key thing about this fish is the spiritual lesson Jonah learnt as a result of his incarceration within it. That's his function in the story. It's quite clear, I think, from the psalm that comprises chapter 2, that Jonah thought he was either dead or certain to die. He was, as he says in verse 1, in the depths of the grave. His life was, verse 6, imprisoned in the pit, and verse 7, ebbing away. I'm not even sure we are intended to conclude that Jonah knew he was inside a fish. I mean, put yourself in his position, I don't suppose he knew what had happened to him. The kind of language he's using suggests quite strongly that he felt he was transported to the underworld, what the Greeks called Hades and the Jews Sheol. It was a place of dread and hopelessness. And in that place of doom, Jonah prayed. Prayed as he had never prayed before. In my distress, verse 2, I called to the Lord. From the depths of the grave, I called for help. Have you ever had an experience like that? Have you ever found yourself teetering on the raw edge of terror? Ever felt death was only inches away? Only once in my life has anything remotely close to that ever happened to me. It was some years ago now, while I was walking the North Devon cliff path on my own. I foolishly attempted a shortcut across a cliff face, which rapidly degenerated into something far too close to solo rock climbing for my comfort. At one point, my footing gave way, and just for a moment, it was just my fingers holding on the rocks above that was preventing me from falling a very long way. That was a very salutary experience. First and last time in my life that I can remember I felt like shouting, as in all the best adventure stories, "Help!" But it wouldn't have achieved much if I had called help. But I was alone on that cliff face. Alone and helpless. Maybe you have an experience like that you can recall. A moment of danger, or a moment of despair. A moment when you felt yourself confronted with a situation you just could not handle. If you have an experience like that, then you will empathize with Jonah in his fish. And maybe you can learn the same lesson he did from it. Because, of course, the trouble with most of us is that we don't feel helpless, and we never have. Isn't that the truth? Like prosperous Israel under Jeroboam II in the 8th century BC, everything has gone consistently well for us. We come from stable enough families. We are financially prosperous. We've been successful at school and at college. Our bodies are healthy. Our appearance is even attractive. In short, we feel thoroughly in control of our lives and pleased with ourselves. People like us are just too complacent for our own good, aren't we? We need to have the solid ground whipped from under our feet. And make no mistake about it, sooner or later God will do it for us. For till, like Jonah, we have felt our human helplessness, A, we're never going to appreciate why the Bible talks so much about salvation. And B, we're never going to feel very motivated to pass on the message of salvation to other people. Too many of us, you see, raised in the midst of Western affluence and security, think of ourselves as strolling securely along the cliff path. We've never experienced what it's like to be clinging by our fingertips to the cliff edge. To put it bluntly, we have never felt what a terrifying thing it is to be under the judgment of God, to need his deliverance and to need it desperately. Jonah learnt that. He learnt it in the fish's belly. Can you imagine just for a moment what it would be like to be on death row, sentenced to execution, knowing that in a few days' time you were going to the gas chamber or the electric chair or whatever? And then, at the 11th hour, you are reprieved. Can you imagine stepping out of the prison gate, a free man, feeling the sun on your face, a sun you never thought you'd ever see again? That's how Jonah must have felt that morning. That morning the fish developed a divinely induced nausea and vomited him up on the dry land. See, an experience like that changes a person, doesn't it? It's much more difficult to say no to God when you've just spent 3 days and three nights screaming to him for help. So tell me, must God put you in the whale's belly for 3 days and three nights before you will say yes to him? Be warned. If you force his hand, he might just do it. And that brings us to the lesson of the vine. Look at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3. The Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. Then the word of the Lord came to Jonah a second time. Go to the great city of Nineveh and proclaim to it the message I give you. Jonah obeyed the word of the Lord and went to Nineveh. Well, there you are then. You would have thought that was the end of the story, wouldn't you? The reluctant missionary has at last said yes. And just look at the salutary effect his preaching has in Nineveh. Verse 4. Jonah started into the city, going a day's journey, and proclaimed, 40 more days and Nineveh will be destroyed. The Ninevites believed God. They declared a fast, and all of them, from the greatest to the least, put on sackcloth. When the news reached the king of Nineveh, he rose from his throne, took off his royal robes, covered himself with sackcloth, and sat down in the dust. And then he issued a proclamation. By the decree of the king and his nobles, do not let any man or beast, herd or flock, taste anything. Do not let them eat or drink, but let man and beast be covered with sackcloth. Let everyone call urgently on God. Let them give up their evil ways and their violence. Who knows? God may yet relent and with compassion turn from his fierce anger so that we will not perish. Why, if Billy Graham had gone to Cuba and converted Fidel Castro and his entire Communist Party, it would not have been more remarkable. This is an evangelistic triumph of the first order. Surely such a response is every missionary's dream. But no, extraordinary as it must seem, such a response was in fact Jonah's worst nightmare. Verse 10. When God saw what they did and how they turned from their evil ways, he had compassion and did not bring upon them the destruction he had threatened. But Jonah was greatly displeased and became angry. Well, you see, it's galling to have gone public on a vital piece of news like the end of the world, only to find like a damp squib on bonfire night. It doesn't happen. It doesn't go off. I mean, Maria Devi Christos in the USSR must feel a bit like that, having predicted the end of the world a few days ago, mustn't she? Maybe that Australian press officer is feeling similarly mortified, having discovered that the report of the Queen Mother's death was somewhat exaggerated too. Jonah felt peeved. He'd said 40 days and it was all going to blow up. Nothing happened. But it wasn't just the non-arrival of the judgment that had made him look foolish. No. It went deeper than that. Jonah also was feeling personally disappointed. Look at verse 2. He prayed to the Lord, "Oh Lord, is this not what I said when I was still at home? That is why I was so quick to flee to Tarshish. I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger and abounding in love, a God who relents from sending calamity." He knew it was going to happen, you see. He suspected as much. Do you know the old story of the dog and the cow? The dog was much loved by his master, but then one day his master bought a cow, and the dog began to get very jealous. So the dog began to lie on top of the cow's manger whenever the food was placed there. He couldn't eat hay himself, of course, but he was jolly well going to make sure that cow didn't eat either. Well, Jonah here is being just such a dog in the manger, isn't he? He wants the mercy of God to be the exclusive property of his own people. He didn't want God to forgive Assyria. He wanted to see the Assyrians blown apart by the judgment of God. Perhaps 3 days and three nights in that whale's belly hadn't been enough. But then it is surprisingly difficult, isn't it, to disentangle yourself from your racist and your nationalist prejudices. Surely you found that. Do you remember an incident in the Gospel of Luke? It's actually in chapter 9. Jesus was in a Samaritan village, and the people refused to give him hospitality. James and John, his two disciples, got very angry. "Typical Samaritans," they said. "Typical Samaritans. Lord, let's command fire to fall from heaven and consume the lot of them." And Jesus said, "No. You don't know the kind of spirit you belong to. I did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them." Jonah needed to learn that lesson too. Do you? That girl in your college, for instance, you know, the one from the snooty private school? She always makes you feel inferior, doesn't she? Do you really want to see her converted? What about that boy who is so obviously gay? You know, you always feel so uncomfortable when you have to queue next to him in the dining hall for the food, you know? Do you really want him sitting next to you in the CU Bible study? That woman whose skin is so much darker than yours. That man whose accent is so much broader than yours. That person whose intelligence you envy, whose success you resent, whose social background you despise. That person who has upset you, ignored you, insulted you. Do you really want to see them numbered among the people of God? I mean, really, deep down. Honesty in this matter is not always easy. I remember some years ago, a girl came to me and said she was feeling very guilty. She just heard that her parents had become Christians. "Oh, that's good news," I said. "Well, that's my problem," she said. "I feel very guilty about it, but I don't really feel pleased." She explained to me she'd always had a hard time with her parents, never had a good relationship with them. Becoming a Christian for her had been a kind of way of escape. It was something that belonged to her, if you know what I mean. Her Christian friends were her friends that she'd made for herself. Her Christian identity in the church was her world. Her parents couldn't interfere with her there. Somehow now they'd become Christians too. It was as if they were pursuing her. Their smothering presence was going to engulf her again. Now, sometimes it is hard to say you really want someone to become a Christian. There is in all of us that streak of selfishness that wants to keep the mercy of God confined to our comfortable little circle, isn't there? It's the Jonah in us. So difficult for us to imagine that God really means it when he says he loves the world. I mean, the world, God. Do you realize who belongs to the world? You can't be serious. I mean, you can't include them. But I'm afraid he does. He wants to have mercy on Moscow as well as New York, Dublin as well as Belfast, Newcastle as well as Virginia Water, Cape Town as well as Harare, Serbia as well as Bosnia. He may even want to have mercy on your parents. God's compassion is so much bigger than we can possibly imagine. You see, he doesn't write people off the way we do. And if he's calling us to share his work of salvation, he will not allow us to limit ourselves to that little group of people in whose company we feel secure. For there are others, thousands of others, millions of others, who need to hear his call to repentance and his offer of mercy too. He insists, therefore, that if we're going to be his, we break out of our little cultural isolation, our little exclusive little clique. He insists we cross the hurdles the world doesn't want to cross, of racial and tribal and national prejudice. Love your enemies, says Jesus. The world will teach you how to love your friends, but if you're going to be my disciples, you must love your enemies the way God loved you, even though you were his enemy. So who do we have here tonight then who is saying no to God? He's calling you to become a Christian, isn't he? But you're saying no. He's calling you to give your life in service of him, isn't he? But you're saying no. Maybe he's even calling you to be a missionary. And you are saying, no. Saying no, perhaps, because like Jonah, your idea of God is just too small. You think you can escape his call upon your life. Forget it. There is no running away from the hound of heaven. Saying no, perhaps, because like Jonah, your experience of God is too shallow. You've never really known what it is to cry in desperation for his help. So must he lock you away in the whale's belly for 3 days and three nights before you learn how precious a thing it is to be saved? Or saying no, perhaps, because basically you just like things as they are. You're happy with the status quo. You don't want the church to grow. You don't want the CU to grow. You don't want to have to make the effort of relating to new people, different people. You don't want to be a missionary. You don't want them on the inside of your Christian world. Learn the lesson of Jonah. And learn it quickly. Or you may find to your shock that in saying no to God, You're saying no to heaven itself. Let's pray together. As we're quiet and thoughtful, here are some lines written by Michel Quast, a French priest. I am afraid of saying yes, Lord. Where will you take me? I am afraid of drawing the longer straw. I am afraid of signing my name to an unread agreement. I am afraid of the yes that entails other yeses. And yet I am not at peace. You pursue me, Lord. You besiege me. I run after noise for fear of hearing you. But in a moment of silence, you slip through. I turn from the road, for I have caught sight of you. But at the end of the path, you are there, awaiting me. Where shall I hide? I meet you everywhere. Is it then impossible to escape you? But I am afraid to say yes, Lord. I am afraid of putting my hand in yours, for you hold on to it. I am afraid of meeting your eyes, for you can win me. I am afraid of your demands, for you are a jealous God. I am hemmed in, yet I hide. I am captured, yet I struggle, and I fight, knowing that I am defeated. For you are the stronger, Lord. You own the world, and you take it from me. When I stretch out my hand to catch hold of people and things, they vanish before me. It's no fun, Lord. I can't keep anything for myself. The flower I pick fades in my hands. My laugh freezes on my lips. The waltz I dance leaves me restless and uneasy. Everything seems empty. Everything seems hollow. You have made a desert around me. I am hungry and thirsty, and the whole world cannot satisfy me. I am afraid to say yes, Lord. Father God, tonight we pray that your kingdom may come, that your will be done, that you will enable us to say yes.